Cruz, Sandy, and Scott.
Plays balls out every time.
Oh, my God.
Cruz, Sandy, and Scott.
Wait a minute. Don't run this jive by us.
Cruz, Sandy, and Scott.
It was like I was a genius. Oh, hey.
This is Drew, Sandy, and Scott.
So you, my friend, are on crack.
So, yeah, it's probably, I don't know if it's a cliche, maybe, and maybe you can say it's a bad excuse. I agree.
Here's Drew, Sandy, and Scott.
Our third and final hour, Drew, Sandy, and Scott on your home for the best live local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. It's Sandy and Scott here for hour number three in studio. Drew will be on the telecasting call tonight for Miami Root Sports as the Rockies open their 2014 season against the Miami Marlins and Jose Fernandez. We are joined by the good Dr. Rick Perea, professor of sports psychology, Metro State, and the University of Colorado. This is always an interesting time of year, Dr. Perea, in sports. We have the Final Four now established, the opening of the baseball season, the stretch drive in the NBA and the National Hockey League. But under any circumstances, it's always good to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Great to see you, Scott. Great to see you, Sandy. Excited.
You two
for...
are color coordinated. Your footwear and Scott's...
You know what is funny? And I got shoes that match this top that I almost wore, but I just went with the solid black.
Yeah. But the difference, mine, Sandy, these
a
are
sure sign of spring.
Yeah, these are wingtips. These aren't sneakers. These are wingtips.
His are professorial shoes.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Mine are running out of here as fast as I can after the show shoes.
Yeah. All right. How's your pool doing? How's your pool holding up?
It was destroyed after the first two nights. It was done. I mean, I didn't do very well.
You, with your background?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did badly?
Yes.
I'm shocked.
And I'm proud of it. Yeah, because here's the deal. I mean, you look at some of the games and the outcomes. I mean, there's so many variables than to just the X's and O's and the scheme. There's the mental influence. Obviously, that's my expertise. That's my area. But there's so many variables, how teams travel, how they prepare. There's so many variables, Sandy, that it's hard to really pick it.
You've had Kentucky as your most interesting team in the tournament. They stand out for you. And you're saying, although next to Connecticut, Kentucky is the long shot at the Final Four, they should not be considered a surprise. A team that lost 10 games, that spent a lot of time late in the season, not even ranked in the top 25. They're not a surprise to be in the Final Four.
Not at all, because you look at them, I mean, athletically, they're, you know, personnel-wise, they're very good. But, you know, in industrial organizational psychology and in performance psychology, we talk about the four levels of performance, and that is teams form, then they storm, then they norm, and then they perform. So it's actually quite healthy, Sandy and Scott, for teams to really storm for a certain period of time. You look at the Giants a few years ago, 8-8, win the Super Bowl. The Green Bay Packers go 16-0, lose in the first round. So we look at organizations the same way in terms of performance, that storming, and that's that level of really finding out where you fit, where the players fit, where the coaches, you know, have their authority. Storming is a really healthy level. And, you know, the Wildcats stormed a little bit longer than people thought in terms of their productivity. But you look at Calipari, he didn't panic. He kept coaching. Players kept playing. And now I think they're at a level where they're actually performing. And quite honestly, I think they got a shot. They got a shot to win.
Don't you think, Dr. Key, then, is when you can have the talent. There's no question Kentucky is a talent. They're preseason number one just on the recruiting class that he had. Everybody loved him anyway. But it's now mixing that athleticism with that chemistry that every team has to have, the roles that are all played within the forming of that team and that team chemistry. And when those two things can come together, that's how you get national champions. That's how you get NBA champions, Stanley Cup champions.
Sure, yeah. And by the way, Scott, what we do is we research team cohesion, and we do it at all levels. And so people call it chemistry, but for us it's called cohesion. And that is that teams learn to play together from a task.
You say tomatoes or tomatoes?
Tomatoes.
Okay, good.
Okay. But here it is. So you got task cohesion, and that's players, you know, fulfilling their roles, adhering to their roles. Coaches fulfilling their roles, adhering to their roles. Then you have social cohesion. And what happens is when you take care of that task cohesion, which can be the storming phase, okay? Some guys don't fall into that. Some guys don't accept that. They don't adhere to it. That's that storming phase. Then you go into more of the norming phase, and that's when cohesion is start to build. And so what you're talking about is chemistry is when you can combine or marry cohesion and chemistry with personnel, then you got a chance to really play not only to your capabilities, right, but sometimes above them.
And the accepting of roles. I mean, I travel with the Nuggets, and if I could say one thing from a mental standpoint, there was not a cohesion and an acceptance of where each player needs to be.
Yes.
And yet, when I was on a team that won an NBA championship in Detroit, the first dinner I had with Bill Laimbeer, you know, he takes David Greenwood and I out to dinner, and he goes, by the way, we protect our guards. However far our guards go, we go. Our team is our guards. We take care of them.
Right.
And there was an automatically definition of this is what your role is going to be.
Yep.
Here's where you are. And then everybody liked each other, and we beat the brains out of everybody.
Well, and what happened at that dinner is there was a definition of the roles first.
Yeah.
Because here's what
happens.
Within
that group, though. Not by a coach.
Right.
Within the group.
Sure. But here's what happens. A lot of times, roles aren't defined. You know, we come into organizations all the time and we work with them, and people, you know, managers, upper-level managers, team leaders have not defined the role. And so they're wondering, well, why isn't this person adhering and accepting their role? Well, it hasn't been defined for them. So what you defined was very accurate, that whether it was in your group or team, the roles were defined. Then they were accepted, and then they were adhered to.
Right. Right. And another thing, I'm sorry, because I never get to be in the room with you, but I always listen to you guys on the radio. And I heard you say it a while ago. And it's one thing to define the role. If I'm the leader, coach, whatever, of a team, say, you're my leader. Well, that's great. I may have defined that role for you, but that is going to go against every nature in your personality. I'm not going to win in that situation.
Right.
The team's not going to win in that situation because that's not what you're capable of doing.
Right. And I look at, you know, I think it was Coach Carl last year. And I like Coach Carl. You know I like him. But he, you know, I think he tried to make Ty Lawson into a visual, verbal, and vocal leader. And he's not. He can lead, but he doesn't necessarily lead in those three Vs, verbal, vocal, and visual. And so what coaches need to understand is, yeah, you know, we have reverent leaders, people that lead by example, people who are quiet leaders. They do it, you know, just by suggesting things. And then you have those charismatic leaders, which I think is what he wanted, right, you know, him to evolve to. But that really didn't fit him.
Well, and can I say something? I just me, and I may be completely wrong. In the pro level, you better have one of those charismatic leaders.
Yep.
Every team has to have a charismatic guy, and sometimes it can be a coach. I'm not sure that Patrick Wall coming into the Avalanche, you know, because Landeskog was your captain, but he's a 20-year-old guy.
But he's a kid. Right.
That Wall came in and said, okay, I'll be the charismatic guy to start this thing off.
Yeah.
And in some way, eventually, we'll have to take that mantle from
him
within the locker room.
Yeah, and what a lot of people don't understand, they think of charisma, and it is that person has great communication skills. It is that person that can connect with people. But the psychological element of charismatic leader is they evoke emotion from their followers. And enough people don't talk about followership and how that's interdependent with leadership. See, leadership has no power unless followers give them that.
Yeah.
You know, people
great
can
point.
Lead.
Right.
People can lead, right. But a follower will not lock in step until they give them that power. So those two are interdependent and psychologically interdependent with each other.
Well, that was the old Chuck Daly line that you know so well, Scott, where he says that about the NBA players, you have to get their permission in order to be able to coach them.
Right.
That's the same.
Right. Yeah.
He said the same thing in a slightly different way that you're saying here,
right,
Doctor.
Absolutely. Yeah. Followership is more powerful than leadership. Leadership with the power of followership can take you beyond capabilities, but you've got to have that followership giving the power and influence to that leader.
And you've probably all seen that. There have been teams throughout history. There have been businesses throughout history that have those followers that are just begging to be led and never are.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you see it in the corporate world. You see it in the business world. You see it on teams. You know, one of the things that I think at a core level a lot of coaches don't understand is you have groups and you have teams. Okay, a group is a bunch of guys. I can go out in the street and get a bunch of guys together. That's a group. A team are people with the same objectives. So you can have a team that becomes a group. In other words, they were a team at one moment. They were going in the same direction, pulling on the same rope, grabbing the same paddle, but then they become divided. Now they're a group. Coaches need to understand, you know what? We've become a group. How do we get back to being a team? It's vital for performance reasons.
That's fascinating. We'll continue along these lines
here,
Dr.
Sandy,
Rick Perea.
Thanks, finally, for letting me be in this room with you guys. Instead of sitting, I feel like I should go down my truck and
sit in my car.
You
got a little man crush going on here.
I always
the good
have.
Doctor.
Yeah. But I think this is the most underappreciated part of sports, especially in the pro game, because once you get to the pro level, there's talent abundant. There's enough talent for everybody. Even Philadelphia, who just lost 25 games, they have talent. How do you get to the next level? And the next level might just be a little bit level up. But then the next year it's here. And then it's here.
Exactly.
And then you have something special.
We'll talk more about what Dr. Perea describes as the mental process taking shape during the NCAA basketball tournament. What he means by that as we continue at 2:13 on your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. .217, Drew, Sandy, and Scott on your home for the best live local sports talk. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Sandy and Scott in studio with Dr. Rick Perea. Before we continue, we'll get back to the basketball talk. You had a point to make about Kane Coulter in the Northwestern case, which the Northwestern players won. And you have a theory as to why he won, and it has nothing to do with the notion of pay for play. Right?
No.
Kane took a more nuanced position than that, and it paid off for him. Those of us who know Kane Coulter a little bit played at Cherry Creek, both football and basketball, a good friend of my son's, and so we were pulling for Kane for a lot of different reasons. But Kane came with the right stuff at the end, and it paid off for him.
Yeah, absolutely. He backed off a little bit on his pay for play. That was in the beginning, that was a piece of it.
Yeah.
But some of his advisors said, you know, we better back off on this because really there's not a lot of ground to stand on. And I think it's a good thing he did because I agree the players do need some representation. My thing about the pay for play is I think about my college career and I'm getting paid back every day by what my experience is.
Sure.
I mean, you know, the influences of my coaches bleeds off into my life and my career. I probably wouldn't have a PhD today if I didn't play under my defensive coordinator. Probably wouldn't be as good a father, although I'm sure I can still improve. My wife would tell you. But I wouldn't be the person I am without those experiences, and I think they pay off every day. So when people say, you know, you need to pay them, we get paid, we get scholarships, but we also take away that qualitative experience that we are paid every day by the influences, the great influences, the great leadership that we learn from our coaches and other players that were play around.
He was more about the medical protection at the end.
Right.
That's kind of his line of study, too.
Yes.
So, I think he's exactly right. They should be protected.
But and going to the medical study stuff and the health issues goes to the big buzzword that's in the consciousness of a lot of fans, right?
Absolutely.
So it becomes smarter that way.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right. The mental process that's taking shape during the tournament. We talked about Kentucky, Doctor, a few moments ago. Now we get to Florida, Wisconsin, two of the more favored teams. But UConn, which should at this point be certainly a bigger surprise than Kentucky, more of a long shot.
Yeah.
What's UConn doing in the Final Four?
Yeah, it's a good question. But again, it gets back to performance. It gets back to, you know, forming, storming, norming, and performing, and leadership. You know, there was one game I watched, and I'm gonna think outside of the circle here and go over to the women's side. I was watching Fordham University, which is a school in the Bronx, by the way. Fordham University was playing Cal. And Fordham had the lead late in the fourth quarter. I mean, they had like a three-point lead with less than a minute to play. And I'm watching it on TV, so I can't get all the nuances. But I'm looking into the faces of those Fordham players, Sandy, Scott. And I tell you what, they looked to me like they were trying not to lose. And this is where the mental process occurs. I think a lot of those players kind of turn around, looked at themselves and said, oh, my gosh, are we beating Cal? You know, Fordham's not a doormat or anything, but they're certainly not a big power school. And I think what happens is we talk about relevant cues and irrelevant cues. And I saw those players looking around other places than the bench at each other and kind of taking this position of they weren't very sure of themselves. And so when we look at attentional focus in sports psychology, we look at relevant cues versus irrelevant cue. An irrelevant cue is crowd noise, is hecklers, is the score, is the time on the clock. A relevant cue is their practices and protocols, you know, whatever it is, footwork, technique, you know, boxing out. Those are relevant cues. And so you look at a team like a Fordham University, the mental process took over because I'll tell you what, Sandy, they should have won that game. And it wasn't physiologically based. It was psychologically and emotionally based, and that's the reason they lost that game.
I always see if this fits into this, because I've used that before, and you can tell it almost. And listen, I don't have a PhD, but I did once stay at a Holiday Inn Express.
Well, you know what PhD stands for?
No.
Piled high and deeper.
Yeah,
so.
Well, there you go. Well, maybe I do have a PhD. Maybe I am good. You could see teams do this, and you could see them all of a sudden start as play it safe, if you will. Michigan State, Sandy, may have done that a little bit in the second half when they got the 9-point lead because they never did anything below the free throw line. But it's the same thing that I always took kids with free throws. You see guys shooting the first half, first quarter, you know, whatever, and the ball's flying, it's loose, it's free, and then all of a sudden now it's a 1-point game and there's 45 seconds on the clock, and how many times have we seen that person now get up there and they can almost – you can almost sense that they don't want to release the ball from their hand.
Right.
That we always call the invisible string between the forearm and the bicep.
Yep.
And I've always said, when I've always taught kids, that's where you've got to be so into your routine that the time and score, that makes no difference.
Yes.
Bounce on the ball, bend your knees two times, flip your elbow in, cock it, shoot it. And so for me anyway, it was all about my form and my routine that I was able to, and I actually made a couple big free throws late in games because it didn't bother me.
Right. Yeah, and see, what you were actually practicing there, Sandy, was one of the psychological skills training that we teach. We talk about two relevant cues, and all the rest are irrelevant. Let me give you an example that's close to home. Metro State last year played in the national championship game in Division II.
Got Final Four this year.
Final Four this year. Okay, so last year they had two kids that had the front end on 1-1. They were behind by 2 points with a minute. The first 1-1, kid goes up there, short arms it, okay? They get another chance, a 1-1. There's like 30 seconds left, okay? Same thing, a different player, short, hits the front of the rim. They come back, I teach there, they come back, and I let a week go by. I wasn't going to go get in their head right away, but I said, you know, what were you thinking when you stepped to that free throw line? Just wanted to get cured. Because I don't work with them. I work with the women's team at Metro, but I don't work with the men's. Not trying to postulate, but I'm just saying. So here is what they told me. They said, you know what? One of them said, I thought about this is the national championship.
Wow.
We're behind by two. There's only 30-some seconds left.
I have to make them both.
My parents came all the way from Australia, right? They're asserting all these irrelevant cues.
Yeah.
The relevant cues are two things. One thing, routine and technique. Routine and technique. Everything else is irrelevant. And so what we teach athletes, when you learn to focus on two relevant cues, everything else becomes irrelevant. So you're very astute to postulate that. You must have learned it somewhere.
I don't have any idea, but I always found it easy because I know when I was in college once I missed a free throw like that, and I remember we ended up winning the game. But it was in triple overtime. We could have won it in like double.
Sure.
And I remember going back, well, why did I miss it? I was okay free throw. And that's when it hit me. I was worried about too many things that matter. So for the rest of the time, all the way into my pro career, and I think I was an 81% free throw shooter, it was always for me was my routine.
Yes.
And I would say it to myself, and I could do it today.
Yep.
It was 1, 2, 3 bounces, 2 knee bends, elbow in, cock the wrist, release.
Right.
That's all. And I would say that stuff to myself in the head all the time.
Now, absolutely.
I can't do that in a golf course. I always say, don't hit that tree and watch out of bounds. But I haven't learned to do that in golf yet.
You got to learn to filter out those irrelevant cues. Golf is one of the toughest sports mentally. So,
quickly on Wisconsin, Bo Ryan in the tournament, in the Final Four, for the first time.
Yeah.
A lot of years at Wisconsin.
Yes.
How do the players respond to that? You're talking about cues and things to take that are important, unimportant.
Yes.
Is that something that matters to players, should matter?
Absolutely. What Wisconsin should have, what every team should have, and I'm biased when I say this, Sandy, but I'll tell you what, every team should have a mental enhancement coach. And that's somebody that reminds these players, okay, here are the relevant cues, here are the irrelevant cues. These are what we need to focus on, especially when you have a team that hasn't been there in quite a while. You know, the Floridas, the Kentuckys of the world, these people have been there. But this team is really going to have to focus on filtering out some of those irrelevant cues, because now everybody at their school, everybody and their fans are saying, wow, you're in the Final Four. And if they want to win it, it can't be about just being there. It's got to be about winning it, and that is when you're going to have to filter out all that external noise, and that's what we call irrelevant cues. The other thing that helps with them is if they're operating on a high level of team cohesion, task, and social, that'll help them filter out irrelevant cues automatically. So, again, if they have a mental enhancement coach, I'm sure that person, he or she, is reminding them. But my guess is they probably don't have a full-time mental enhancement coach, which, again, I'm biased. I think every team, especially as Scotty said, at least at the college and the pro level, need them.
I was impressed by the way they got through Arizona, because I thought that was a game played above the shoulders,
yes,
in the psychological sense.
Absolutely.
A team that gave them problems, challenged them offensively with a great defense that Arizona played.
Right.
And they kind of had to win on some level, beating Arizona kind
of. But Sandy, think about this, though, with the March Madness. We got to go. How many times do we see these guys win those first two games? They go back to their schools for the week, and they're the big men. OC, I can't believe it. Do it. Everybody's getting them hugs. Then they come out there for that Sweet 16 game, and bam!
Right.
They just get absolutely pounded.
Right, yes.
We've even seen it to the Final Four. They have this great run. They get the Final Four, and they almost get satisfied to be there, and everybody loves them anyway, and then the performance stops.
Yes, and we'll talk about performance a little bit. We got a few issues to get to with Dr. Pria very quickly in the next segment. Some of your texts as well. Good questions and comments on the Total Beverage text line at 29588. Drew, Sandy, and Scott, Dr. Rick Pria, the in-studio guest. As always, your home for the best live and local sports talk is Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Drew, Sandy, Scott, Dr. Rick Pria, our in-studio guest. Your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Sandy Clef with Scott Hastings. Drew getting set for the Rockies opener tonight in Miami against the Marlins. We also want to invite you to join Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan on opening day as we broadcast live, starting with the Fan Morning Show at the Denver Chop House at the corner of 19th and Wine Coop on Friday. Stop by and donate two cans of Campbell's Soup to Food Bank of the Rockies and receive a commemorative T-shirt while supplies last. Remember to get your Campbell's Soup at your local Safeway after the game. Come back to the Denver Chop House as we recap all the opening day action. Brought to you by the new I-25, the all-new I-25 Kia, now open in our new facility just minutes from Denver or online at i25kia.com. Dr. Rick Pria, our in-studio guest. Okay, you say performers are performers. What do you mean by that?
I mean that performers are performers. It doesn't matter if you're an athlete, a surgeon, a firefighter, a public speaker, a radio host, you perform. And the autonomic nervous system doesn't know the difference. And that's what's fascinating, Sandy, is because we're finding now that whether you're a public speaker or you're a quarterback, you make decisions based on, you know, the arousal and anxiety levels that really are exhibited through your autonomic nervous system. And so when we work with, for example, first responders, we talk to them about regulating arousal, which is the physiological part, and then the anxiety. And so it's really important to understand that in terms of sport performance, it's really about just regulating and reaching optimum levels of arousal and anxiety. But performers are performers. And again, if you look at our society and our culture, basically all of us perform. I worked recently with a surgeon who had a great practice going for about 15 years and then developed some more a general anxiety disorder and was really self-medicating himself to get through his work. And it's really sad to think about. I don't want a surgeon working on me who's medicating himself to get through his work. So we worked with him and gave him some of the same protocols that we do with athletes. We taught him how to regulate that arousal, that physiological. I mean, here's what it comes down to. The sympathetic nervous system gets you excited. The parasympathetic cools you down. We taught him to regulate that sympathetic nervous system so it never got too highly aroused. Therefore, his anxiety level wouldn't get at elevated levels. Therefore, he was back to his normal self in terms of performing in the operating room.
My brother fights huge anxiety. And he's a self-educated kind of guy. I call him, if the world ever ended, we see all these apocalyptic shows where then bartering becomes the financial way of the world. My brother would be the king of the world. I mean, he once traded a lawnmower one season. At the end of the year, he's driving around a brand new Corvette. I mean, it was all in barter.
Yeah.
But that lifestyle and count on that, I think, has increased his anxiety. So it'll be the same thing. He's not a surgeon, but that always having to be at the top level of what he's doing, he brings up the, he didn't use the big words, but the other part of it that
the arousal.
Increases that anxiety then.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you don't understand how to regulate that arousal, then it's going to eventually lead to higher levels of anxiety. And then anxiety is a performance killer. Okay, let me repeat that. Anxiety is a performance killer. And so we've got to understand that, regardless if you're an athlete or you're in the business world or you're a firefighter or whatever you do, a public speaker, for example. There are people that are great public speakers, Sandy, and then later on in their career, they'll develop a general anxiety disorder and they can't perform at the same level. So it's really, when we talk about performers, we really mean that from the psychological perspective.
Couple of texts that I want to get your response in reading here. Let's see, from the 714, Dr. Perea, the Avalanche mantra this season is why not us? Is this a good way to take on a season or even a postseason, Dr. Perea, or should the thinking be more like it should be us?
Yeah, I like the it should be us because it's a strong belief system. Why not us is more of a passive position. I like the it should be us. I mean, and really, when you think about it, all those players are building a belief system, or an efficacy is what we call it, based on their experiences. I mean, look at their record. Look at what they're doing versus what people expected them to do. And when you listen to Patrick Waugh talk, you know, he's a guy that really kind of exudes a belief system. And he's not necessarily a Pied Piper kind of guy, rah, rah, rah all the time, but he's very systematic in his communication. He's very purposeful in his communication, and I think it's been very effective with that team.
Does someone have to eventually take over, though?
Say that?
A player now eventually, as this thing grows and evolves, a player kind of picks up that banner and goes with it?
I think it can. It doesn't always have to be. I think, as you said early on the show, it either has to be a coach or a player. Sometimes it's both. Right. But it depends on the dynamics of each individual team. Each individual team takes on its own personality in and of itself, depending on the players and the leadership skills that are either there or non-evident.
Let me give you an example. I talked to an NBA head coach one time earlier this year, and a player who, on the surface, you would consider should be a leader, a veteran guy in the thing, comes to him and goes, hey coach, we got guys in here listening to music loud, you know, 45 minutes before the game, and they're supposed to have it all turned off, and they're supposed to be off their phones and everything like that. And so the coach said, well, what'd you say to him? And the guy goes, well, nothing. He said, well, wait a minute. It's your locker room. You know that they're not supposed to be doing it. So why didn't you say something?
Well, here's the deal, Scotty. Who teaches leadership? I mean, where do you learn leadership? You know, people throw that word around all the time and say, oh, so-and-so is a good leader. Well, are they? I mean, you know, we mistake leadership with verbal ability sometimes, and that's not necessarily two of the same. Some people are natural leaders in the sense they're very confident people, they're very charismatic people like we talked about, but some people are reverent leaders, and that means that, you know what, they put themselves or the good of the team first and themselves second. Those are still leaders, but they lead in different ways. This guy, whoever you're talking about, probably wasn't the three Vs, verbal, vocal, and visual. But, yeah, leadership is not really taught. And so what I want people to understand is that, you know what, when you have a leader on a team, it's important that you use them and cultivate them so they can develop the personnel and really the overall climate and culture of your organization.
We're going to we have time to get this question in. And we were talking about this quote, and I mentioned earlier on it was from Troy Tulowitzki. Actually, it was Cargo Gonzalez telling Troy Rank of the Denver Post yesterday, talking about the Rockies' prospects looking ahead to this season and about whether the stars should be kept or traded on. Here's what Gonzalez had to say. You could clean the house and still keep your best players. You might get young players for us, but sometimes they never develop, and that takes you further away from winning. I want to win. I think of Todd Helton with only 2 playoff berths and 4 World Series games in 17 years. That's depressing. I don't want to go through that. I believe we can win here, and that keeping us two together, including Troy Tulowitzki, gives us the best chance. We had a text. Let me see if I can find it here real quick earlier this hour. Ask the doctor. Losing it here. Ask the doctor about what it must be like to be incredibly talented, too low in cargo, but play for an owner and GM that are clearly inept and no real success in sight.
Yes. Well,
and that quote, that's not a knock at Todd Helton. That's a knock at the Rockies for not surrounding him with sufficient talent.
Right. Well, okay, here we go again. How does the front office people understand the role part, the role acceptance, role adherence, the role definition? Do they understand team cohesion? Do they understand how team that is developed? So, you know, you'll hear people talk all the time, Sandy and Scotty, about team chemistry. We play together. We play for each other. Well, what the heck does that mean? Do front office people know? Do the managers really know? We research this stuff. We know how it's built. Cohesion is built through task adherence, through role adherence, role acceptance, and then social cohesion that takes that team to the higher level. So my point is that, you know, everyone's talking about personnel, personnel, personnel. Keep them, don't. What about having all your bullets in your holster? And one of those bullets is the mental enhancement piece. Having someone on your staff that understands how to cultivate cohesion from a task perspective, from a social perspective, so that your players can deploy their true physiological self. One of the saddest things I see, guys, on a daily basis, I see athletes, and it starts at the adolescent level, that do not deploy their true physiological self because they self-handicap. And sometimes it's parental influence, sometimes it's coach influence, sometimes it's a dynamic of all three. But it is so sad to think, here's a kid that's got all this physiological competency, but they don't deploy it because they need a checkup from the neck up.
We want to get to what you're talking about. We have a text here, and we'll lead into the break with a text and get you to react on the other side and clean up a little business before we get out of here. At the top of the hour, we'll make way for the drive and Big Al and D-Mac. From the 303, I need this doctor to literally just hang with me for about a week and rid me of my thoughts that screw with my head. So your first impression with us here this afternoon between 12 and 3, doctor, has been a good one.
Absolutely.
So I want
it's been
you to
a blast.
React to that a little
yes,
bit.
And I will.
A couple of other texts as well. Sandy Clef, Scott Hastings in studio with Dr. Rick Perea, professor of sports psychology, Metro State University of Colorado, on your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. At 2:47, Drew, Sandy, and Scott on Denver Sports Station, your home for the best live and local sports talk, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Sandy Clef and Scott Hastings in studio with Dr. Rick Perea. And I want to get your reaction before I let you go to our fan poll. We have results to date. How many wins will the Rockies have this year? Let you delve into the fan psychology on this. Not surprising numbers. Choice A, 90-plus wins, 5%. Choice B, 80-89%. 29%. C, 70-79 wins, 45%. D, 60-69, 18%. E, less than 60, 3%. So basically, almost 3 out of 4, doctor, have the Rockies winning somewhere between 80 and 89 games, 70-79, almost 50% have the Rockies winning 70-79. What does that say about the fan psychology, if anything?
I think they're thinking with their heart, not their head. I think when you think when
you,
you think
they're too optimistic.
When you think they're with their head, you're processing, you're thinking, okay, what are the elements that tell you this team is going to win a lot of games? And if you look for me, again, let's go back to what we were talking about earlier, and that's that team cohesion. Task and social cohesion. How are they going to build it? Do they have it starting from the top down? Because I'll tell you what, if you don't have it in the front office, if you don't have cohesion in the office, it's hard to trickle down. Can it be done? It's been done before, but it's not a model. It's not, you know, it's not modeled in their daily procedures. So I think that's the key. And I don't blame fans. Fans tend to think with their heart more than their head. That's why I'm around, to remind them that they need to think with their head.
So you think that's too optimistic?
I do.
In fact, that you think that there are 34% of the people who have them winning 80 games or more. That's more than a third. You think it should be more like 20, 25%, or maybe less than that even?
Yeah, I mean, I think this team wins in the neighborhood of 60, 65, 67 games, just based on what I've seen so far. Again, I'm not real sold on the front office in terms of their cohesion, understanding where they are, where they're going. So with that in mind, I just don't see them winning more than that many games.
Doesn't that, what you and I were talking about during the break, quantitative and
versus qualitative?
Qualitative, because quantitative says, well, I've got 300 hitters. I've got two guys that can hit 35 home runs. I've got a third baseman that has a range of X numbers, X, Y, Z. That's, and because of those numbers right there, it tells me I should be pretty good. That's quantitative.
That's quantitative.
But if I got a pitcher that anytime you get two balls in a guy, panics more times than not, that becomes your qualitative.
And serves up a meatball.
And serves up a meatball because he didn't want to get to three balls.
Right.
That becomes a qualitative issue that no one wants to deal with.
Yes. And what, you know, when we talk about human performance in sport, it is human behavior. How they deploy themselves on the field, on the court, in the pool, whatever the sport may be, that's human behavior. And that's the qualitative element. That's why I say there's no upsets, because you just never know any given night how any team's going to play. That's based on their qualitative performance with each other, interacting with human behavior. Anybody can do quantitative analysis. Quantitative analysis is simple. It's just putting the numbers, crunching the numbers, and coming out with probability. And that's what we look at. It's the probability that this will happen. And does that have weight? It does. But the really high-performing teams are the ones that figure out, like you mentioned, Scotty, Doc Rivers says, it's about chemistry. It's about cohesion, people. It's about getting people to play together. And we've researched this and how to do it. So for those teams that don't have someone on board already doing this stuff, they need to get them there.
This is to Scotty's point, the so-called cybermogenics.
Cybermogenics.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you spoke earlier this hour, and we'll conclude on this note, about how there are an insufficient number of mental enhancement coaches, advisors, consultants in sports today. We certainly don't appear at the present time to have a shortage of analytic guys.
Right.
Particularly in the NBA, Major League Baseball. Those two sports in particular, not so much NFL or NHL, although there's some of them, more in basketball and in baseball.
Right.
My sense is you're more on Scotty's side in believing there is an overemphasis on one and not nearly an emphasis on the other.
Absolutely, because again, who's doing these quantitative analysis? What's their competency? What's their acumen? I'd like to know that, because again, anybody that can really do any kind of formulas and inferential and probability and statistics can do quantitative analysis. And it's easy to say, well, there's a 75% chance this team's going to win based on past performance. Okay, that's fine. That's easy to predict. But what I want to know about, I want to know how we get teams to play together, play with each other, play for each other. High levels of cohesion, Sandy. You know, when you watch a team play like that, it's unmistakable. They're just so cohesive.
You can tell.
You can tell. You can feel
within
it.
Within 5 minutes.
Yes. You can.
Especially in college basketball we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Right now in the tournament.
Absolutely. And when they play that way, you can sense that. And I'll tell you what, when you have mental enhancement coaches, and again, here we go again, back to Nick Saban. You know, he's got four or five people that he employs for mental enhancement only because he understands how important that is. I wish more coaches understood that and would really rely on that more, because that's where we're going to grow in the next 20 years. It's not through analytics, but it's through qualitative analysis and understanding how people perform at peak levels through task and social cohesion.
Which you look at the San Antonio Spurs in the NBA, and I know they've had some great players. They've had great players. We've seen a lot of teams with great players don't have the kind of run they've had. 17 straight years in the playoffs, 15 straight years of 50-plus wins. And that includes a strike-shortened season, you know.
Well, they still won 50.
And they won. They went 50-12 or whatever it was. There's got to be some of that quantitative stuff going on.
Qualitative.
Or qualitative stuff going on, not just quantitative.
Well, okay, answer me this. Do you think Pop defines roles?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. He's structured. He defines roles. People adhere to their roles. And because if they won't, he'll get in their stuff. He is one of the few coaches that you see on the professional level that understands how important role adherence, role acceptance, and he defines those roles. And then that leads to task cohesion and social cohesion. That's why his teams perform at high levels, because he starts it at the bare level. He defines those roles, and he makes sure players adhere to them.
It's always a pleasure, Doctor.
Absolutely.
I know it's your first time with this audience. The text response has been overwhelming and outstanding.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
I know Scotty
Great
appreciates
seeing you,
it.
Scotty.
Oh, not in the car. Let's do this again. I'm telling you what, this is the most important part of sports. And as I've gotten older, and I've done the plane, and I've done all this, and as I get older, as you said, the shoulders above decides more championships, I think, than just pure talent.
Yep. Check up from the neck up.
Check up from the neck up.
It's always a pleasure. Dr. Rick Perea in studio with us. We hope you've enjoyed it. And Scotty will be back here doing this once again tomorrow. You've got Nuggets Memphis tonight. Memphis fighting for a playoff spot.
Sitting at number 8, I believe they are. 43-30 or something like that.
So it looks like you got Dallas, you got Phoenix, you got Memphis. Two of them are going to make it.
Yeah.
One of them won't. You have any feelings on that?
I don't know how Dallas is one as many games as they are.
I don't
think they're that good.
Phoenix, and the Nuggets have killed them this
Phoenix
year.
Phoenix,
the exception of one game,
doesn't have the talent that Dallas or Memphis has, but they play together so well.
The chemistry thing.
And there's a
about.
Chemistry thing going on, and there's a cohesion going on, and there's a defined roles that has gone on with them, because everybody thought they were going to be a lottery team. They have like five first-round picks in the next 2 years. Yeah. They thought this year they'd be a lottery team, and here they are fighting for a chance to be in the playoffs.
Of course, we'll see Memphis against the Nuggets tonight down at Pepsi Center. Avalanche on the road, leaving for Columbus today. They'll play Blue Jackets tomorrow night. Opening day, we'll have a review of the Rockies' initial performances tonight against a terrific starting pitcher in any case, and Jose Fernandez, a fine young right-hander who brings back memories of Doc Gooden with the Mets. Almost 30 years ago. D-Mac and Big Al are standing by, set to join you on the drive. Coming next on your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan.